It's good actually. It's an excellent description. First of all, thank you very much for the invitation. I'm very delighted to be here. Today I will be talking about mass gap, topological molecules, and strong gauge dynamics. Since the work that I've been doing since some years now, it's getting embarrassing, maybe 4 or 5 years, I don't know. But most of it is done in 2007, so I will essentially summarize the progress that happened during that year. Okay, so mass is a concept that all of us is quite familiar. It appears first in classical mechanics in Newton's law. It is when you apply a force to a body, it of course accelerates, but there is an inertia to this acceleration. There is a resistance to this acceleration, and it's called mass. Okay? In quantum field theory, mass appears in a different context. So by this I mean a quantum field theory without a mass scale, without a mass, or without any scale whatsoever, may generate a mass. So this is roughly what takes place in nature. And I aim to explain it as much as I can during this talk. So I will first tell you very simple experimental origins of the mass gap problem as well as the statement of the problem. Then I will give you a microscopic description, microscopic origin of mass gap in gauge theories, in particular a quantum field theory called quantum chromodynamics. I will give a broad brush overview of some recent techniques and my contributions. Okay. So first, my talk has essentially two parts. The first part is quite elementary, and the second part is still non-technical. And I hope it will be accessible to everyone. At least it will give you a flavor of what I am doing. Okay. So this endeavor started at the beginning of the earlier century with the famous gold foil experiment, or Rutherford experiment. Here the idea is you have some gold foil and you just shoot some alpha particles. And the standard expectation at that time was that, you know, these alpha particles would just deviate a little bit according to the current paradigm of physics then, and it would just hit the foil. But once in a while, something very strange happens. And I think it is best described by Rutherford's own words. He says, it is as if you fired a 15-inch shell at a piece of tissue paper. That's the theoretical expectation of the time. And it came back and hit you. So this happened once in a while, okay? And it really gives you a lot of intuition about what he was expecting and what happened to be the case, and it is quite drastic, okay? Then upon further consideration, he reaches to the conclusion that mass of an atom is concentrated in a very tiny nucleus. And this is the birth of nuclear physics, okay? Now, I will just fast forward in time. I will go to late 60s to early 70s to Stanford Linear Accelerator Center, SLAC, and there was a set of experiments called deep inelastic scattering experiments. Philosophically, these experiments are very close to Rutherford's experiments. The only difference is, you know, in Rutherford's experiment, you are able to do everything in a room, which is few meters, but now, in order to probe shorter distances, you need a larger microscope, which is few kilometers, so you need faster particles to hit your probe. So, but the result is almost on the same footing, okay? What we learned is following. There were, people previously were thinking that, you know, proton, a jelly-like structure where charge is nicely uniformly distributed, okay? Then again, people were expecting that electron would scatter, but by just small scattering angles, okay? But the result was, of course, again, opposite. There were more electron bouncing back with high energy at large angles than that could be explained if protons and neutrons were uniform spheres of matter. Of course, this led to a Nobel Prize almost 20 years ago to these experimentalist gentlemen. And the main result of this experiment is following. This is the atom. It's quite large. It is 10 to the 4 times larger than the nucleus. And this is a picture of the nucleus. So the results are, I am just stating the results. The hadrons, this is called a hadron, either proton or neutron, they have a substructure. There are 3 points of deflection much smaller than the proton size. And quarks appear as point charges and as if they are almost non-interacting. Later experiment also suggested that the existence of something called gluons, an electrically neutral glue binding quarks together. These are the results of the experiments from that epoch. Okay? There are 3 debriddles about these experiments. One of them is this almost free parton, or parton is quark, essentially, picture. It is very successful, but this is a force that is known to be extremely strong. And it was hard at first to reconcile the idea of being almost free with a force which under other circumstances would be very strong. The other thing is that the absence of any massless particles in the spectrum, and the thing which led a lot of skepticism at the time, the absence of observation of isolated quarks and gluons. This is very different from our experience in electrodynamics. If you have an atom, you shine a light on it, you can excite an electron, you have an ion, you have an electron, but we never see, for example, by shining a light to a proton, we never see a quark in isolation at all. Okay. Now, the first question is actually addressed in the past, but the last two are probably among most important unsolved problems in high energy physics. But you know, in some sense, people view them as impossible, and people also think that they do not admit any good approximations. So perhaps we should not work on them. But I think that ignorance will not lead any progress. So perhaps we should try to think different ways. So let me first address the first issue. Quantum field theory, which governs the dynamics of these quarks and gluons, is called quantum chromodynamics. Okay, and quantum chromodynamics has a coupling which is similar to electric coupling, and it has this remarkable property. This is the energy axis, and this is the strength of the coupling. Coupling is not a constant; it depends on the energy scale. And if you are at large energies, it is pretty weak. And as you go to lower and lower energies, it becomes stronger and stronger. This property is called asymptotic freedom. Short distances weak, and at longer distances, it is strongly coupled. Okay. Now, in quantum field theory, the flow of the coupling constant with energy or length scale is called something called beta function. And this is one of the things that we can calculate in QFT. It is now straightforward textbook material. And the calculation by Gross, Wilczek, and Politzer was the first example of a quantum field theory in which beta function turned out to be negative. That means asymptotic freedom, things becoming weakly coupled at shorter distances. Up until that date, all the calculations done in quantum field theories in any dimensions always led to positive beta functions. That means the theory becomes strongly coupled as you go to shorter and shorter distances. And there is something called Landau pole, and at that point, the coupling becomes infinite. And this led most people to believe that for some time, that QFT were ill-defined at short distances. And this simple change, the simple flip in sign of a function, of a beta function, changed our perspective of quantum field theory for good. Otherwise, the calculation was not that difficult. You know, it is the fact that it changes our perspective. Now, I want to address the second and third problem in this talk. And also during the talk, if you have questions, please ask, but this part is pretty elementary, I understand. Now, let me address the second and third questions. Let me tell you the inputs of QCD. For example, if you take a proton, it is composed of almost massless up quark and down quark. And in units that high energy physicists use, it's called MeV, they are of order few. So the combination of two up quark and one down quark, which has the quantum number of the proton, is of order 10. And the theory also has exactly massless gluons. These are like photons in some sense, force carriers. But if you look to the outputs of QCD, if you look to the proton mass is almost 1,000 MeV, so 1 GeV. So if you, and there are also other particles, but let me not bother with them for the moment. And for comparison, for example, electron mass is 0.5, so it is, proton is 2,000 times heavier. The thing I want to draw your attention is that this is 1,000, and two up quark and one down quark is 10. Okay? So only 1 in 100 of the mass of the proton is coming from up and down quark, okay? And there is some stuff which we do not fully understand. And the rest I'll try to address now. So these strong interactions, gluing together proton, generate almost 99% of the mass of all the matter on Earth, you know, our human bodies, this computer, this desk, whatever you see around us. So even if you go, as theorists, we are often inclined to go to a hypothetical theory which doesn't have any quarks, and that theory is called Young-Mills theory, okay? Even if you go there, there are still massive particles whose masses are comparable to the proton mass. They are sometimes called gluballs, although microscopic theory only has exactly massless gluons, okay? Now, either form of this problem is called the mass gap problem. And it is literally the mass that everything we see around us. Okay? Now, there is also a formal statement of this problem by Claimant Institute. It says Young-Mills existence and mass gap. And it says prove that for any compact simple gauge group G, a non-trivial vacuum for Young-Mills theory exists on R4 and has a mass gap delta greater than zero. There are some axiomatic properties that one has to establish, these Osterwalder-Schrader. 2 months ago, I went to a constructive quantum field theory conference at, you know, at Simon Center, Stony Brook, and I heard the words Osterwalder-Schrader more than, you know, I heard it in the rest of my life. So, and this is indeed a serious problem, and there is literally $1 million prize at the end, but I am happy with the pursuit of the knowledge for its own sake, you know. Who cares? But it is not the easiest way to make $1 million, I can assure you. And the problem, in my opinion, is much more worse. But there is a solution, but maybe Claimant Institute will not accept. Go there and weigh yourself and calculate your mass and divide it to the number of protons and neutrons in your body. And this is the delta that's appearing there. I can assure you they are the same. And this is the mass gap problem, okay? Now, there is also another mass problem, and you shouldn't confuse the two. It has a much better PR, but, you know. So the other problem is also a very serious problem. It is, you know, standard model of high energy physics has these, all these quark and lepton generations, and they also have their own masses. For us, for our human bodies, what matters is are these guys, this guy, electron, and this photon and gluon, essentially. And there is the question of how the elementary particles acquire their masses. And for us, this really makes accounts for remaining 1-2% of our masses. But the problem of electroweak symmetry breaking is a serious, very important problem, and it's currently probed at the LHC, at Large Hadron Collider. But my curiosity in the last few years was the former problem. And I think this, the difference between this problem is reflected in the difference in the viewpoints of these two gentlemen, and I leave it to you which one is which. So it's your. Now, in the rest of this talk, I will address two interrelated ideas, two interrelated developments, tying it to the earlier part of my talk. I will discuss the mass gap problem and something called large and volume independence. The general theme, let me first tell you the general theme. The general theme is inferring the properties of infinite volume theory. By infinite volume theory, I mean we are living in three-dimensional space in with x, y, z, let's say Cartesian coordinate system. There's also time. And theoretical physicists who are dealing with quantum field theory often analytically continue time to an ordinary Euclidean coordinate and work on R4. And for certain quantities, we know our way back to the Minkowski time. So there is no distinction for the purpose of my talk to take R4 or R3, 1, which is the Minkowski space. So let us start with R4. And we can do certain compactification. You know, we can compactify it on a cylinder, R3 cross S1. We can compactify it all the way to a four-dimensional torus and shrink the space of the size of the space. With some, this space has some characteristic size L, but the crucial thing here is that I always want to keep the theory locally four-dimensional, so I can use this radius as some sort of expansion parameter to study and to understand non-perturbative dynamics of the theory. Okay, so I put some work here, large and volume independence, and I have to explain it to you what it is. Okay. Now, what is large and volume independence? And I will do this by using very elementary methods from electrostatics, so it should be clear to everyone at the end of it. Consider, for example, a point charge on R3. Its potential is 1 over R. Take an electric charge. And let us consider Maxwell theory, U1 electromagnetism, quite simple. And now compactify one of the dimensions to a circle, so make the space R2 times S1. So you have a cylinder, you have a charge on the surface of this object. All of us know method of images. If you would like to find the potential induced by this charged object, we just put this replica of the charge, we just unfold this topology, and we just calculate the potential at some distance, okay? If you are at very short distances, very relative to L, very close to this charge, its field is 1 over R. Okay? But if you are here at very far distances, this will look like a uniform charge density, and a uniform charge density has a potential logarithm R. And this transition from 1 over R to logarithm R will happen roughly at the scale L. Okay? So the characteristic length scale at which the potential or interaction between charges changes from a three-dimensional behavior to a two-dimensional behavior is L, and this is very intuitive. So you can even compactify more dimensions, you know, by using Gauss's law, you know, it 1 over R become log R, and this will become absolute value of distance. This is the potential, okay? And we know this from freshman physics, even from perhaps high school. Now, whereas volume independence demands the following. If you do more and more compactification, reduce the space X2, then X1, and all the way down to 1D, it tells us that the interaction between charges must be 1 over R, 1 over R, 1 over R. It doesn't depend on X2, X3, or here on X2, so and so forth. So if you have two charges which are far apart, and you curl up the space, it tells you that the interaction should not change. This, of course, sounds outrageous. It almost sounds like a joke, because it exactly counteracts our intuition based on electrodynamics. Okay? As strange as it may sound, this assertion that I made in this previous page, this simple observation that I made in the previous page, turns out to be an exact property of certain non-abelian gauge theories in the large N limit. This one and much more. Okay? It's really an exact property. Back in 1982, two clever gentlemen, Eguchi and Kawai, showed that for some of the most interesting aspects of gauge theory, including spectrum of the theory or if you have string tension of the theory, remains invariant, provided as you shrink the space, there are no phase transition as the volume of the space is shrunk. Okay. There may be some symmetry consideration here. I just sidestepped that and said that, you know, for the purpose of colloquium, just no phase transition. It suffices for our purpose. I can be more rigorous, but it's not necessary. The only problem with this proposal, with the Eguchi-Kawai proposal, was that nobody found a single theory which satisfied this provided condition. Okay? So, well, but assuming that that provided holds, the reason that we should care about this equivalence, the large N volume independence, sometimes called Eguchi-Kawai reduction, sometimes called large N reduction, the reason we should care is following. If this is true, for example, consider the Schrödinger equation for the quantum field theory in infinite space on R3. And there is some set of states, gauge invariant set of states, there's a Hamiltonian, and if the equivalence is true, you can reduce the space on R3 to a point. In a lattice formulation, you can reduce an infinite lattice to a single site and keep time continuous for the sake of this purpose. And the Hamilton, the eigen spectrum of the Hamiltonian must coincide with the spectrum of the theory in infinite space. So in particular, the separation between vacuum state and first excited state is the mass gap. So the promise of this equivalence is that spectrum of large N gauge theory must be equivalent to spectrum of the quantum mechanics of large matrices. Okay? So if we really understand then how large N volume independence works, we will most likely gain a new way to think about gauge theory different from lattice gauge theory, because it tells us that we can capture lattice gauge theory in infinite volume by using a lattice gauge theory with just one side. Okay? So, and the punchline is large N QFT is same as large N matrix quantum mechanics, if this is true. Okay? So, since, yes?
This is assuming there's a unique ground state and equal to Kennedy.
Number of ground state doesn't matter. If this is valid, if, for example, the theory on R4 has multiple vacua, quantum mechanics at n equal infinity limit will also have multiple vacua. Because you are in the thermodynamic limit, there is a spontaneous breaking of any symmetry. It's already thermodynamic. But in pure Young-Mills, you do have a unique ground state. And if this is valid, you will still have a unique ground state when you reduce it to quantum mechanics. But it's not a necessary condition, unique ground states. But now, before telling you the progress, let me tell you how this works, how this could be possible, because it sounds so outrageous. Now, infinite space, momenta is continuous. We know it. It is a continuum. And if you compactify a theory on a space with size L, we know that in perturbation theory, the spectrum is discrete, and it is quantized in units of 2 pi over L. It is really particle on a circle. Okay, it's very easy. And it's how it is quantized. Assuming that this provided condition holds, for example, I'm just compactifying one circle, then the spectrum is still discrete, but its quantization is in units of not 2 pi over L, but 2 pi over L n. N is the number of colors in gauge theory. Okay? Then you immediately observe the following. So what does the compactification mean? The compactification mean making this discrete spectrum continuous in perturbation theory. We can do it in one of the two ways. Here is the discrete spectrum. I can take L to infinity, and all of these states will come down and will form a continuum just like this. Okay? There is another option, which is associated with this. You can keep L fixed, and if this provided is satisfied, then you can take NC to infinity. This again forms a continuum. It's very bizarre. Your space has size L, and the perturbation theory forgot that it is on a space of size L. It is really the basic intuition behind this. There are rigorous statements, but this is what you should get out of a colloquium. Yes. Questions?
Well, okay, but aren't there solutions of the large N matrix model which decompactify into spaces of different dimension and different topology?
There are.
And
there may be, yes.
And expanding around those, one will see a different spectrum because one will see something that looks like a free spectrum in different dimensions.
If this works, for example, from quantum mechanics, if you look to fluctuation around certain background matrices, it will look like a higher dimensional field theory with some fluctuations on that.
Right.
So the question, so I agree with that.
So that suggests there might be phases, or different phase transitions between different phases guided by expanding around these different...
Oh, very good, very good. I will come to that. Yes, it's a very good point. Yeah, I will come to that. Yeah. I will demand something much more restrictive, and I can comment on that in private as well. But you will see that in our case, we will guarantee absence of phase transitions. Okay, but it's a very fair point. But now, in this case, if the spectrum is much finer, then the characteristic length scale that the physics changes from a two-dimensional physics, things like 1 over r interactions to log r interactions, is no longer l, but it is n times l. In particular, at fixed l, if you take n to infinity, it is the three-dimensional character of the theory never changes. Lower dimensional character, three-dimensional character of the theory never changes, despite the fact that you can take space to be tiny. Okay? This is, at first, counterintuitive, but it is correct. Okay? Now, of course, given that this is the case, because of the attractiveness of the idea, there had been serious efforts on this subject from 1980s to 1985, and many, many good field theorists worked on it, including David Gross, Migdal, Kazakov. They wrote some very nice, interesting papers. However, there was always a phase transition when the space shrunk to small volume, and this was invalidating Eguchi-Kawai reduction, this volume independence idea. Technically, what these gentlemen did is that there is an effective potential calculation for some order parameter which probes this phase transition. And this calculation always gave a negative sign for all gauge theories. This is a true statement. It's not a joke. And we needed a positive sign. Okay, that was the status. Then, okay, this order parameter is tachyonic, instability is bad. If it was zero, we would be maybe a little bit content, but if it were positive, we would be very content. But whatever they did, I think the best way to describe the outcome is really this figure. They hit a stumbling block. They couldn't move anywhere, okay? So people have forgotten about this subject. And I learned about this problem when I was a grad student when I was doing a journal club. Okay, then a few years after that journal club, I realized that in supersymmetric gauge theory, the analog of that potential was actually identically zero. It was the marginal case, and there was no such examples in the Eguchi-Kawai. I immediately realized there is something funny going on, and I looked at the calculation. And at the heart of the calculation was this non-trivial identity. Okay, there was some contribution which was created in a tachyonic mode, and there was another contribution in the supersymmetric theory due to fermions, which was creating opposite effects. Okay, you get an effective potential which was zero. This is the marginal case. Then, if you look to the calculation more, you see that it is really minus one times some stuff. Plus one times the same stuff turns out to be zero, okay? But the crucial point that was observed was following. This plus one did not necessarily appear due to supersymmetry. We knew because of supersymmetry, the right-hand side must be zero, but the appearance of that was essentially due to boundary conditions of the fermions. People used boundary conditions in supersymmetric theory which respected supersymmetry. In particular, they used, instead of anti-periodic boundary condition for fermions, periodic boundary conditions. So it no longer had a thermal interpretation, but on the other hand, it also provided that marginal case. So if you by deduction, you can immediately make this 1, 2, because you are just increasing fermion number from 1 to 2, okay? And this constant, this part, minus 1 plus 2, is positive, okay? Then you immediately learn that if you have two adjoint fermions instead of one, as in supersymmetric theory, you are done. This is the solution, okay? So in some sense, the inspiration came from supersymmetry. In supersymmetry, instead of partition function, we define this quantity. And in a supersymmetric theory, Ed Witten told us that this is an index. And it is very useful. But for non-supersymmetric theory, it's not an index. Okay? It is some twisted partition function, sum over the bosonic Hilbert space minus sum over fermionic Hilbert space. You are essentially probing the behavior of the theory, not as a function of temperature, but as a function of volume. But the utility of this guy for non-supersymmetric theory is understood only recently. And this is the minus 1 plus NF that I was alluding to. All prior calculations in this more than a quarter of a decade always gave negative results here. Supersymmetry was 0, and Kovtun, myself, and Leriafe deduced that for NF greater than 1, this was positive. Okay. So then large N volume independence, the so-called Eguchi-Kawai reduction, holds for QCD adjoint with periodic boundary condition. As you go to smaller and smaller volumes, there are no phase transitions at N equal infinity limit. Then a year after, maybe in 2008, Leriafe and I found, I will not talk about it, but I want to state this. In ordinary Young-Mills theory, there's a phase transition, but we found a very nice deformation. And in the deformed Young-Mills, we were able to go all the way down to arbitrarily small volumes with no phase transition. And there was a deformation equivalence at large N here, and there was a volume independence for the deformed theory here. And this theory provides the Eguchi-Kawai reduction for the Young-Mills theory on R4. So this is indeed the first working example of the beautiful idea of Eguchi-Kawai. Now you can ask, can we use this quantum mechanics to solve for the gauge theory? This is really a work in progress. Numerically, after 2009, these early works of Barak Bringholz and Steve Sharp, it gave a lot of encouragement. It in fact validated what I told you by using lattice simulations, but analytically, it is still very hard, but it is different from, for example, trying to study lattice gauge theory. It's a different problem, so there may be hope. Okay? Now, from now on, I will not talk about large N. This is the progress that happened then. I will stick with finite N, maybe NC equal to, number of colors being equal to. And I will talk about both mass gap problem and the confinement. Now, what we learned out of this ordeal was that the theories which had, we found a class of theories which did not have any phase transition as you dialed, for example, the size of the circle from small S1 to large S1. Asymptotic freedom tells us that at small S1, theory may become weakly coupled, okay? In these theories, there was a regime, if we fix N, I'm not taking N to infinity, and if we take L small, then these theories become analytically calculable. You can study non-perturbative properties systematically. You can study confinement. Oops. What happened?
Some noise. Maybe you can click PC and then come.
Oh no, I didn't.
Yeah, but
click here again. Okay.
Yeah.
Are they coming? Do we know?
I think so.
Thank you very much.
Try RGB on the counter.
Yes. I pressed RGB.
Okay, just give me a second. I have it, but you don't. I'll be right there.
Okay, thank you. Sorry about this. If it doesn't come back, I can continue on Blackboard. It doesn't matter. Either way is fine. Maybe we can wait 2 minutes.
Maybe you can explain something in the meantime.
Yes.
You said as the size of the circle gets smaller, the minimum momentum doesn't go up when you have many colors.
Indeed,
why
yes.
Why is that?
Okay, very good question, actually. When we do ordinary Kaluza-Klein decomposition, of course, momenta is quantized in units of 2 pi over L. Okay? But whenever these... is there a chalk? Yeah. Here. But whenever these center symmetry is unbroken, what happens is that, okay, there is this Wilson line, omega, Wilson line, and the eigenvalues of trace of omega is equal to 0, trace of omega square is equal to 0, so and so forth. And the eigenvalues of the Wilson line do get uniformly distributed. And in the ordinary case, in perturbation theory, when you discuss perturbation theory, you are doing an expansion around zero gauge field. And you have these, all the eigenvalues are accumulated, and the modes are quantized in 2 pi over L. And in this case, this behaves as some sort of adjoint X field. Call it omega, some adjoint X field. And if you put it back, to the action, the distance between these points behaves as some sort of the distance between this point as are masses of the states in perturbation theory, and that distance is 1 over n times this 2 pi over L. The circumference here is 2 pi over L. This is the dual circle in which the eigenvalues live, and the separation between two points on the dual circle when these conditions are satisfied is quantized in units of 2 pi over L and C. But the picture should tell you many things. You know, this is the, you know, when we do perturbation theory or classical theory, we are expanding around a mu equals 0, but here we are expanding around some background field. Yes, Lee?
Yeah, if you can compactify and decompactify without a phase transition, is what you're about to, I'm just trying to give you an impetus for going on. Is what you're about to say, you can go smoothly to the three-dimensional case?
Yes.
The 2+1-dimensional case, and there's much stronger calculational control of behavior in the theory in 2+1-dimensional.
Let me tell you two things. One thing that we have learned, which is very important, when you talk about compactification, the intuition prior to our work was that if L times lambda is much less than 1, then this is weakly coupled domain, okay? This was, you know, result of all people, but this actually turns out to be incorrect. The correct statement turns out to be, when this center symmetry is unbroken, L times NC times lambda is much less than 1. This is the weak coupling domain, weak coupling. So in particular, if you in particular, but volume independence demands that this scaling of L, volume independence demands that scaling of L should be order n to the zero. But this domain, what is this domain? This is some semi-classical domain where we can do analysis. We can do reliable analysis of all the topological configurations. You know, we believe that semi-classical analysis is correct. We trust that. And when this quantity is much less than one, we can do that. But it also tells us that regardless how small L is, okay, if L is order n to the zero, it's order one in the large n. If you take nc to infinity, there is no weak coupling. It tells you the absence of the weak coupling. If there are people experts in, for example, supersymmetric gauge theory, Seiberg-Witten theory, there is a very similar issue in Seiberg-Witten theory. If you solve it in the large n limit, there is a nice solution by Douglas and Schenker. Okay, large n limit, the theory again abelianized. You may naively think that now I can take mass to be large and go to interesting theory, but it turns out you have to take mass of order 1 over n to the power some positive thing. You cannot take arbitrarily large mass. So it tells you that these two phenomena are actually continuously connected to each other. So in this case, it tells you that although L is tiny, there are many states below it, and the theory is crucially strongly coupled. This is the reason that we cannot really solve these quantum mechanics theories or matrix models, at least by the methods that we have now, but it doesn't mean that we will not be able to solve them forever. It's really a different problem. Perhaps, you know, people's time is also going. I should just do it on the blackboard, the rest. If you want me to, okay, let me,
I will,
but it may take slightly more than I intended, but okay, let's, you were in that part. Yeah. Okay.
You can use this.
Oh, really? Wow. Okay, I need chalks. Okay. So let me go back to the finite n-gauge theory. So n finite. So we are taking L goes to small. And in this in the class of theories that I have discussed, when you take the theory on R3 cross S1, there are many theories in which there are no phase transition and we can study interesting aspects of the theory. If you think in terms of Wilson line is exponential A1, exponential AN, and you see that the eigenvalues in this regime are maximally separated, okay? This tells you that you have an adjoint, this behaves as an adjoint Higgs field. The only difference with respect to, for example, with respect to Seiberg-Witten theory or George I. Glashow model is that this adjoint Higgs field, which is the gauge holonomy, is compact. That compactness has an implication, actually. Usually, when, for example, let me take simplest case from now on, when SU2 breaks down to U1, you expect only one type of topological excitation, something called monopole instanton in three dimension. You have a monopole, and in three dimension, it's an instanton. But this compactness tells us that, you know, there is one type of monopole instanton. Let me call it M1. There is also another type of monopole instanton. Let me call it M2, okay? The existence of the second one is shown by Li, Yi, Piljing Yi, and Li, Kim Yong Li, as well as Pierre Van Baal. Okay? And this is quite crucial for the story that I will tell you. Okay? Now, so now we have these monopole instanton amplitudes. Now, I will remind you something which is historically quite important. I will remind you Polyakov model. In Polyakov model, we have SU2 broken down to U1, but we only have one type of monopole event. Okay, it is, you know, you have some Higgs field, which is not compact now. Let me call it A minus A. and something like that. If you draw the field space and the fluctuation of these guys, for example, when they touch, when they fluctuate, they touch, and there is this instanton events. So in the Polyakov model, what Polyakov was able to show was essentially the following. These are finite action configurations, finite action, finite S naught. And because they are finite action, they proliferate in the vacuum. So let me give you a physical picture. So you can write partition function of gauge theory as a partition function of classical Coulomb gas, classical Coulomb gas of magnetically charged objects, magnetically charged instantons. But this classical Coulomb gas, technically what you do is following. I said there are these monopoles. Let me make one more technical remark because it will be useful. In 2 plus 1 dimension, a photon has only one polarization, one degree of freedom. You can always dualize it to a scalar. Okay? So Fij is equal to epsilon ijk dk sigma. This is called abelian duality. And so if you have Maxwell term, F squared, this maps to d sigma squared, which is the same thing, and coupling constant to get reverted, but let me not go there. And the proliferation of this Coulomb gas is equivalent to deforming this theory. First of all, the masslessness of this sigma theory is protected by a shift symmetry, and the current of that shift symmetry is d mu sigma. And if you inspect this formula, you see that this is really magnetic field, and current conservation del mu b mu is equal zero. If current is non-conserved, that means that there are monopole instantons. Whenever these monopole instantons proliferate in the vacuum, let me make a picture. So it's a Coulomb gas, something like this. This Lagrangian d mu sigma square to get modified as cosine sigma. And if you expand this around, let me put plus and potential is minus, if you expand this around this minimum, it generates a mass gap for gauge fluctuations, and mass gap for gauge fluctuations is exponential S naught. Mass gap square is exponential S naught. Okay? So mass gap itself, I am dropping the scales, but mass gap itself is exponential S naught divided by 2. Okay? The physical meaning of this is following. For example, if you know that the physical meaning you already know from Debye mechanism. If you put an external charge to a plasma, its field, instead of decaying as 1 over r, it will decay as u kava. This is called Debye screening. So Debye screening will change 1 over r interaction to exponential r divided by c, some finite correlation length divided by r. And this c is nothing but inverse correlation length. So Polyakov mechanism is same as Debye screening. Okay. Now, what happens when you go to R3 cross S1? When you go to R3 cross S1, there is a very important crucial difference. Let me call, you see that cosine sigma is sum of exponential I sigma plus exponential minus I sigma. Let us keep this operator in mind, exponential minus S sigma in mind, okay? Let us call this operator monopole operator. On R3 cross S1, in QCD adjoint, there is something quite different happening. And it is, you have this monopole operator, minus S naught, exponential I sigma. But since there are massless fermions, there are fermion zero modes associated with each one of these topological defects. And there is an index theorem. The authors are Nye and Singer. This is a quite recent index theorem from 2000. And it tells us how many zero modes each of these monopole instanton has. And from now on, I stick with SU2 theory. Let me also stick with theory with number of flavor equal to 2 for simplicity, okay? Now, you see that there is this monopole instanton. Let me make a remark. You see that this theory is almost same as Cyber-Quinton theory, but without the scalar. Fermionic content is identical. So this theory has some SU2 continuous flavor symmetry similar to R symmetry in the theory. It also has a U1 symmetry, but U1 is anomalous, because of the instanton effect, it is reduced to Z8. A BPST instanton has 8 zero modes in R4. So this U1 symmetry quantum mechanically is really Z8. But this index theorem tells us that these objects has only 4 zero modes. Okay, M1 is like that. M2 is like that. And you see that the product of them has again 8 zero modes. Now, I will not go into any detail. Let me also follow this so that I will not dwell myself into the details. So, by just symmetry arguments, okay, you see that under this Z8 symmetry, this psi to 4 flip sign. So this monopole operator, in order it to be invariant, it has to have a sigma goes to sigma plus pi symmetry. This symmetry forbids cosine sigma operator. This is forbidden, but cosine 2 sigma is allowed. Okay? So at second order in the semi-classical expansion, you generate this object generates mass gap. So what happens roughly is following.
With 2 S-naught, no?
With 2 S-naught, I'm sorry, yes. Minus 2 S-naught. So you have one object which has certain number of zero modes with certain chirality, another object which also positive charge but opposite chirality zero modes. And naively, you do not expect that such an object to exist. But what happens is quite beautiful, and it is intrinsic to the four-dimensional theory. These two, of course, interact repulsively, then they repel each other. And there is 1 over R repulsion. But fermion zero-mode exchange generates a logarithm R attraction. So, and the combination of two gives you a stable saddle. Okay? So there are these objects. We refer to these objects as magnetic bions because they are pairs. Okay? Magnetic bions. And their characteristic size of the magnetic bion is much larger than size of monopole instanton. And this is much less than can you see this? I will move. It is much less than typical distances between monopoles, and it is much less than distance between these bions. Okay, there is such an hierarchy of the topological defects. It's good. So there is a hierarchy of such topological defects, and consequently, you have these, you know, dilute case of stuff, some rare monopole instanton events, and there are paired up these bion events, minus. And the proliferation of these events generate an effective potential as in the Polyakov model, okay? And they generate mass gap and confinement. Okay. My jokes are gone. I am sorry for that. Okay. it generates some mass gap and confinement, and these are really literally strongly coupled pairs. Now, so it looks like there are three reliable mechanisms of confinement. One of them is from 1977 due to Sasha Polyakov. The other is a beautiful paper of 94 paper of Seiberg and Witten. These are all fantastic and generally accepted to be reliable mechanisms of confinement. And there is this other thing in 2007. This is, I wrote, magnetic bion confinement. You can ask whether there is any relation between these, okay? And at first, we did not think so. But I was aware that I can connect this one to Polyakov confinement by deforming some parameters. During last few years, Eric Popitz from University of Toronto and I realized something quite nice, actually. If you take Seiberg-Witten theory and compactify it on R3 cross S1, you can show that in Seiberg-Witten theory, on R4 or R3,1, there are monopoles as well as dions. If you have a monopole in semi-classical domain, it has a dionic tower as well. And so Then in our theory, there are the monopoles that I am talking about, they are instantons, they are tunneling events. In Euclidean space, they look like particles, okay? In real space, they are tunneling events. One can ask whether there is any relation between them, and a priori, it would be mind-blowing if there is any. There is nothing apparent. But on the other hand, if you take a dion, which has some magnetic charge n sub m, let me choose it to be 1. If you take then arbitrary electric charge, okay? Let's say this object has some mass n m comma n e, but if you compactify the space, and if you go to semi-classical domain of the theory, this can wrap around this compact circle, and L times this quantity can be the action of this object n e, this object which has electric charge. On the other hand, I told you these instantons. These instantons also has a tower, which is classified according to either you can call it winding number or topological number. So let me go this direction. So the quite interesting surprise for us was following. In the semi-classical domain of Seibert-Witten theory, we had these, okay, 3D monopole instantons. And we made a sum over some winding number of these objects, their contribution to, we took magnetic charge 1 and arbitrary winding number in this corner. And here we took magnetic charge 1 and arbitrary electric charge dion on this corner. And there is a very complicated function here. And we are calculating the fugacity of both objects. And there is another very complicated function here, which is a sum over electric charge. And this is a sum over magnetic charge, okay? And the big surprise for us is that these are equal. There is this thing Poisson resummation, and if you just use it, these two quantities are exactly equal. So it shows that the thing that we thought are separate mechanisms of confinement, Polyakov versus Seibert-Witten, they are actually one and the same thing. They manifest themselves differently in terms of different degrees of freedom in different regimes. For example, if you are at small s1, it is wise to use instanton description, monopole instanton description, that amounts to maybe summing up hundreds of real dion particles wrapping around this thing. So it's really s-duality realized in some way in field theory. So this the main picture is that all these three confinement mechanisms are actually one and the same. Okay, and this is from 2011. With Poppitz, okay? So it is very nice. So mass gap generations are also related. Now,
do you claim that they are the same in general or only in supersymmetric
areas? I wish I knew, non-supersymmetric deformation of Seibert-Witten. I'm making a statement about softly broken supersymmetric theory. The theory reduced to n equal 1 with some small mass deformation. So the next part of my talk, maybe I can say it more in words, because at least I want to convey a message to the students somehow. So we have this semi-classical mechanism, but I want to tell you something. Whenever I did either this magnetic bion or with Larry Yaffe, I did similar work. There was one thing that I always felt very uncomfortable, and I also felt equally uncomfortable with Polyakov's work. And the problem is, in these theories, perturbation theory is an asymptotic expansion. This just means that asymptotic expansion really means that it's a divergent expansion, and we are hiding its divergence in a clever way. And this is true. This is true for students, even when we regularize and renormalize them. So it is not due to infinities associated with the regularization or UV structure. It's really by sheer number of Feynman diagrams at each order appearing in these infinite sums. It's very important. So even if you were dealing with simple quantum mechanics, double well potential, perturbation theory is divergent. Okay? Now, and whatever I say from now on is joint work with Philip Argyres. Since he is my collaborator, I have to write his name up here. Okay, Argyres. So These theories are, the perturbation theory is divergent. In particular, even if you do, for example, if you do any, if you, you have this monopole operator, but this monopole operator in principle multiplies an infinite sum here, which is a sum in some coupling, okay? This sum here is divergent. So when I say we calculated mass gap, is it a cheat? Or when Polyakov said that he calculated mass gap for you, is it cheat? Because in reality, a monopole operator multiplies a divergent series and it's infinite. Maybe we are talking nonsense. I wanted to understand this because this is a real issue. And whatever I will address is also an issue for QCD. Okay? So, but what we do in Yang-Mills theory, we declare, we use the Poincaré's prescription with the asymptotic series. We truncate the series whenever the error is minimum. And we say that the error is non-perturbative. But this does not change the fact that perturbation theory is divergent. And it's like, you know, one cannot, I say, hide an elephant under a rock. But then one can ask the following question. Can we give a meaning to perturbation theory? And this is, again, a general question about quantum field theory as well as quantum mechanics. In some cases, there is a way to give a meaning to perturbation theory. It's called Borel resummation. But gauge theory, as well as many quantum mechanics examples, are not Borel summable. They are non-Borel summable. So a non-Borel summable series means the following. It means that you can try to sum perturbation theory, but you get an ambiguous answer. You get many answers for one result that you would like to get. You get manifold ambiguity. Okay? So perturbation theory is ambiguous and does not have a rigorous meaning on its own. This is really important statement, and it's also true for QCD. Okay? This was the status in quantum mechanics. In quantum field theory, the situation is even worse because when you do this Borel transformation, it's a technical jargon. I don't want to bore you to that. There are even worse singularities called Renormalon singularities. Tuhoft conjectured them in late 70s. But nobody really knows what the physical meaning of a Renormalon singularity is. It is a disease of perturbation theory, but how do you cure it? Nobody really understands. You know, is there a semi-classical configuration which may cure the problem with the perturbation theory? The answer is, the truth is, no one really knows, okay? And it's an outstanding question in large orders in perturbation theory. Now, what happened recently is following with Philip Argyres. On R3 cross S1, we have the claim that we understand gauge theory semi-classically by any means possible. The weird thing, let me step back, the weird thing about Renormalon singularity, they are much closer to the origin of the Borel plane relative to an instanton, anti-instanton, for example. They are much closer by a factor of n. If you have large n theory, instantons are quite irrelevant, but you cannot get rid of Renormalon. It survives the large n limits. But now, going back to R3 cross S1, maybe I can put a figure. Going back to R3 cross S1, this is instanton, anti-instanton molecule in the Borel plane. This is some Borel plane, and there are poles here which are much closer than this instanton, anti-instanton. The objects that I discussed here, these monopole instantons, bions, so and so forth, the action associated with each one of them is really, for example, action of these monopole instantons is really instanton action divided by n. But Tuhoft and other guys also observed that these Renormalons are objects which are at action of these Renormalons, roughly speaking, we don't know what they are. It's the result of perturbative calculation. They happen to be instanton, anti-instanton action, or two times instanton action divided by beta function. Beta function is order n. So let me keep it short. So Argyres and I found some topological objects different from these magnetic bions. They are sort of composites of magnetic bions, BB bar pairs, and they induce a multifold ambiguity as well, which is exactly similar to the perturbative result, but opposite in sign. So our conjecture is following. We can perhaps make sense out of the perturbation theory plus semi-classical expansion in the small S1 regime on R3 cross S1. And perhaps We can even give a meaning to what a continuum field theory means. This is the question that Tuhoft posed many years ago, the famous question, can we make sense out of QCD? So this is the current work in progress. So let me tell you conclusions and prospects. Now, I want to say that there are new ways to study non-perturbative gauge dynamics on R3 cross S1 by using this circle compactification or other compactification. This large and volume independence is proving to be a useful tool. And the large and volume independence itself is more moving towards numerical studies. Some serious lattice gauge theories started to take interest in it, and they are using it very wisely. And semi-classical method, it's a branch of its own. There isn't much interest on that yet in the non-supersymmetric gauge theories. So we learned that there are new topological molecules, new mechanisms of confinement, and equivalence of the mechanisms of confinement. We have shown that on R3 cross S1, indeed, we can show what the mass gap is. We can calculate it, and we can perhaps even say that this is really an approximation to something, not some fictitious, not a meaningless quantity. So one possible direction that I'm working with a number of collaborators is implication of these results to finite temperature QCD to and relativistic Kvaerion collision physics and QCD phase transition. And this is work done in collaboration with Dima Karjiev, Gerald Dune, and Thomas Schaefer. And so perhaps I should stop here and take your questions. Thank you very much. Yes, Lee.
Yeah, you said at the beginning that you were not interested in the second problem of mass of electroweak symmetry breaking, but one of the ideas about electroweak symmetry breaking is still on the table is that it is also due to exponent coupled gauge theory.
Yes, there is an idea.
Of a technical theory. And there's a lot of possible phenomenology there. Of course, a lot of it has been ruled out.
Mm-hmm.
There is so much phenomenology. Could there be applications of the work you're doing to
One thing which is crucial there is that the question that people asked, for example, determination of what the conformal window seems to be important to some people for phenomenological reasons, because if you are just below the conformal window, then theory may exhibit this walking behavior which enhances some condensate. So what the best we can say is, some discussion of conformal window of general gauge theories. One idea that Eric Popitz and I pushed a little bit was following. All these objects in this semi-classical domain generate a mass gap and confinement. But let us say we have a theory which is in the conformal window. Moreover, it is in a reliable conformal window, something like Banks X. Okay? What happens in that theory? You can ask that. In that case, for example, what we can show quite rigorously is that there is indeed a mass gap on R3 cross S1, but as you take the compactification limit, it vanishes. So it is consistent with the absence of mass gap in this theory. So the short answer is we can use this kind of techniques to constrain where the conformal window lies, but there are uncontrolled errors there. We cannot say anything rigorous. We cannot say anything precise, but we have some estimates. And they are in the correct ballpark.
I just want to make sure that I didn't miss something. Was there any connection between the first part of the talk and the second part of the talk? I mean, they're both dealing with
yes.
gauge theories in general, but we're supposed to see some connection between
them. The connection is actually related to the question that you asked earlier. When you asked, I mentioned the length scales in the problem. I said that, for example, L times, I said that the relevant parameter is L times and C times lambda in these compactifications. The semi-classical domain that I studied, and I showed these topological objects, is the regime where this is much less than 1, and the volume independence domain is the opposite regime. LNC lambda is much larger than 1. When this is the case, the theory is equivalent to the theory on R4. Okay? Same as the theory on R4. So this is in some sense a caricature of what is going on the R4. This part is caricature of what's going on in the strongly coupled regime. This is, although it is not the theory that we would like to, it's not our target theory, it provides some insight. For example, it tells us perhaps, you know, these objects that we find here, we identify here as renormalons, semi-classical renormalons, continue to be renormalons. So there are some other theories in which we can make this more crisp, but the connection is that these two regimes are continuously connected. This is volume independence domain, the other is semi-classical domain.
In that sense, sort of the two halves are complementary.
They are exactly.
They're both looking at sort of endpoints where the reality is somewhere in the middle. You're trying to close in. Or would you say the first one is?
Okay, in that sense, for example, Larry Yaffe and myself calculated in one class of such theory the mass gap for gauge fluctuations. Okay, let's say this is mass gap for gauge fluctuations in the semi-classical domain, and this is radius of S1. And we did. So the result is following. In the semi-classical domain, it is some non-trivial function of L. But in the other domain where Ln C lambda is order 1, we know that from here there is volume independence. So it must be constant. Okay? But what we do not know is essentially this transition regime. If we were able to see this saturation, we could really say that we are really solving the theory. I cannot see it analytically at this moment, but I have a bunch of very good lattice friends, and they are doing the simulation for this theory from small L to large L and trying to see where it goes.
More questions?
There's one more.
No one else?
Yeah.
Yeah, so can you tell us, you referred to this Polyakov mechanism of confinement. Is that essentially the same as this dual Meissner effect, or is it something, in other words, in the Meissner effect you have...
It's a very good question. You know, I gave a Euclidean picture of it.
Okay,
yeah.
Hold on.
I gave a Euclidean
and
picture of it.
Maybe you can remind
it.
People what the...
Yes. Let me remind, thank you very much. I can remind you very quickly. I told you a description in Euclidean space as Debye screening. The correlation length, Debye length, is essentially mass gap. But he's asking about the other Meissner picture. For that, we have to go to real space. But let me take a Wilson loop, okay? Large Wilson loop. And we can show that it indeed obeys area law. But what is a large Wilson loop? It's an object which carries electric currents. And it generates magnetic fields in the Z direction, in this U1 theory. So it has magnetic fields in the Z direction, okay? But you have magnetically charged objects all around, right? So what happens is that there is Debye screening. You know, all these guys come along and they generate a magnetic field, and they prevent this magnetic field from penetrating to a magnetic conductor. This is the Euclidean picture. For the Minkowski picture, think this direction is time, okay? And take a fixed time slice. You have some quark here and anti-quark there, okay? And you are looking to this slice, and what you see in this space is essentially there is a flux tube between these two, between these chromoelectric charge, these quarks and anti-quark. There is this flux tube. And the thickness of the flux tube is same as whatever you have calculated by using the other methods. And this flux tube is essentially the dual of the usual Meissner effects in the real space picture. So this is the connection. And in this case, of course, there are these flux tubes, electric flux tubes, and you can go from one picture to the other.
More questions? Not let's thank Nipat for this.